Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The Afghan people are actually many peoples, Uzbeks, Tajiks, Hazaras, Pashtuns. For centuries, these diverse communities lived in relative harmony under the governance of tribal councils. Then the Soviet invasion upset the balance and the political turmoil began. The communists and then the Taliban, with their totalitarian ideologies, overwhelmed the old system. As America tries to sweep terrorists out of the caves of Afghanistan, what will it do to reestablish stability among the country's ethnic factions? First, we look at Islamic unrest in Southeast Asia. Militant Islamic groups in Indonesia have been demonstrating against their government's ties with the U.S. for 3 days. Yesterday, the protests turned violent. As many as 600 students tried to knock down the main gate to the parliament building in the capital of Jakarta. Simon Montlake is an independent journalist in Indonesia. Good evening, Simon Montlake, or good morning, your time.
Good morning there, Tom.
It's 7 a.m. Thursday in Jakarta right now. Are more protests expected today?
Yes, we're expecting to see the protesters come back today. Unclear if it's going to be as big as yesterday. But in fact, probably the day to watch will be Friday. We're expecting after midday prayers on Friday, there will be a big crowd, probably outside the U.S. Embassy.
We've seen in our newspapers here this morning that the U.S. is contemplating taking its war on terrorism into the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Is that what sparked the more violent situation in the streets in Jakarta today?
No, that wasn't really the cause. I mean, the momentum's been building for a couple of days, and I think most people out there would say that they are against American actions in Afghanistan, and they're not really focusing on America's intentions to fight terrorism in Indonesia.
There's obviously a war of words on here, a propaganda war. The U.S. is trying to convince the world that this is a war on terrorism alone, not on Islam, not aimed at civilians. So why are Indonesians, or some Indonesians, so upset about the U.S. moves in Afghanistan?
There's a variety of reasons. I mean, some of them suspect the U.S. intentions and don't feel that there's been, a fair public hearing for what they're doing. Others are quite simply, just expressing sympathy for the Afghan people who they say are being caught up unfairly in this struggle. And, within the population, there's always, a fair amount of nationalism and anti-Americanism, which can be tweaked for any issue. In the past, we've seen, large protests about policy in the Middle East in favor of the Palestinians. So I think this is part of the same constituency. And it's hard to say exactly, what they want. Some groups will actually tell you they don't believe it was bin Laden. They think the Americans are just framing him, for example. So, you've got a lot of people who are playing hard to convince, let's say.
Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country. What portion of Indonesians share this anti-American sentiment and skepticism about Washington's role?
I think you could probably find a majority who would have some skepticism, but in terms of actually protesting or threatening violence or, really getting angry about this, it's very much a minority. I mean, as you say, we saw several hundred people on the streets yesterday, a few angry scenes outside Parliament. But, in a country of 210 million, that's not a lot. Jakarta has seen plenty of violent protests in the last few years. Earlier this year, we had up to 10,000 people, protesting against the previous president, for example. So by comparison with that, this really is still quite a small group.
Simon Montlake, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Simon Montlake is an independent journalist in Jakarta, Indonesia. former Afghan king, Mohammad Zahir Shah, now living in exile, has called a Loya Jirga, a great council, to convene next year. At the top of the agenda, resolving the political conflicts that have disrupted Afghanistan since the Soviet invasion in 1979. This council, made up of representatives from every ethnic group and tribe, has guided the nation in times of crisis or change in the past. What do we need to know about these ethnic groups to help Afghans reestablish societal and political order? We're talking this hour about the tribal patchwork of Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us this evening from the University of Wisconsin at Madison is David Morgan, Professor of History and Religious Studies. Welcome, David Morgan.
Welcome. Thank you.
Good to have you.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Kayum Karzai. He's founder of Afghans for a Civil Society. Welcome, Mr. Karzai.
Thank you.
And with us in studio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Always a pleasure to have you here, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
David Morgan, in Wisconsin first, we are all just becoming familiar with these ethnic groups and tribes, Pashtuns, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and so on. Can you please draw the picture for us of this ethnic and tribal tapestry in Afghanistan? What does it look like, and what does it matter right now in the conflict we're involved in?
It matters, I think, particularly because we shouldn't kid ourselves into thinking that you can just remove the Taliban and put the Northern Alliance in its place as the government of Afghanistan, because the Taliban represent at least some part of the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns,
mm-hmm.
Who have, since the foundation of the now existing state of Afghanistan in the middle of the 18th century, have normally been the ruling group. Effectively, the royal family has been Pashtun and so on. I think there's no reason for supposing that most Pashtuns necessarily favor the Taliban at all, but the prospect of having their country governed by the Northern Alliance, which consists very largely of Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, and so forth, that's to say the minority ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
Would be, I think, totally unacceptable to them, and some solution clearly does have to be found, which brings in all these groups if you're to replace the Taliban government with a stable government that represents the country as a whole.
When Americans think of ethnic conflict these days, they probably first think of the Balkans and the kind of bitterness there and the heavy death tolls and the seemingly endless fighting. Is that a model for how to look at Afghanistan, or are the relations different?
I think it's not a good model. Afghanistan is not an artificial construct like Yugoslavia proved to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at the ethnic pattern in Afghanistan, you could make out a theoretical case for saying, well, the thing to do is to divide it up. Stick the Tajiks in the west, who speak a form of Persian, onto Iran, the Uzbeks in the north onto Uzbekistan, the Tajiks in the northeast onto Tajikistan, and the south and east of the country, the Pashtuns tack that onto Pakistan. But what is very interesting is that for all the war that raged all the way through the 1980s when the Soviets were occupying the country, for all the civil wars that have raged in the 1990s, the numerous factions representing one group or another, so far as I'm aware, not one has ever suggested partitioning Afghanistan and dividing it up and turning it into separate countries, as happened in the Balkans, in particular in Yugoslavia.
Mm. Kayum Karzai, you're Afghan, you know the situation there very well. Your brother's leader is leader of the Taliban opposition group, or the opposition to the Taliban in the south, and your father was deputy speaker of the parliament in the late 60s and early 70s under the former king. How should we understand the importance of tribal and ethnic groups in Afghanistan at this point? Are there differences in language, or does it go different? Are there different political leanings among these groups, or is the history that they tend to live together peacefully?
Well, thank you. Let me put the question in a little larger perspective and,
please.
And actually comment about Professor Morgan's proposition here. The most important thing to remember that the ethnic relationship or the ethnic composition in Afghanistan is a condition of life and it is to that extent not very much regulated by politics and by censors and by even going to the extent of answering this question that if you took the Taliban, you would have to put Tajiks in. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. And the most important thing is this, that like all other societies, the Afghan society and the Afghan polity also rests upon unwritten but a customary cooperation in existence between three dominant pillars of the Afghan national identity.
All right.
I would subscribe these three pillars, one being Islam, and another being different ethnic groups underlying national unity, and then the tribal the tribal social value structure.
Mm-hmm.
To that extent, I think, since national unity is a condition of daily living, and that national unity is not necessarily imposed by politics or by the power of government, and it is simply that if one village is of Pashtun ethnic and another village is of Hazara ethnic, and one village wants to irrigate their land, it is a mandatory condition that they must coexist in order for the irrigation to occur in this one village.
For water to flow from one
That's
place
right.
to another, the
That's,
kind of
that,
organic
that is right.
relations. Mm-hmm.
So this makes it actually, it becomes very difficult when all discussions are dominated by politics.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. We're looking at the patchwork of ethnic and tribal identities in Afghanistan and weighing how those are going to come into the conflict that we have waded into, that America has waded into. David Morgan, I want to be sure we understand some of the very simple elements here, and a lot of us are just becoming familiar with this whole scene. Are these ethnic and tribal identities very strong? Do Afghans self-identify by ethnicity and tribe? Are there different languages? Are there sharply different cultures? Or is there a history of blending and not such clear lines?
The lines, I think, are not enormously clear. And if you look at an ethnic map of, for example, where there are Tajiks in Afghanistan, they're all over the place. You know, they're most strong in certain areas, particularly in the west and the northeast, but they're dotted here and there. I think Mr. Karzai is absolutely right. The way I would put it would be to say that normally in Afghan history, central government has not really been that important. That is not what's been mattered. It's not really what matters. There's one big road in Afghanistan which goes round the mountains. It has branches off in the direction of Iran and Pakistan and Uzbekistan and so forth. And there are the big cities on it: Kabul, Kandahar, Herat, Mazar-i-Sharif, and so forth. But beyond that, it's local values and local government and local cooperation, local conflict that has really mattered most, I think. As far as language is concerned, the major ethnic group, the Pashtun, who speak Pashto, certainly, but in my experience, admittedly, it's a long time ago, the most widely spoken language in Afghanistan, and the one you needed to get around the country with if you only had one language, was actually the local form of Persian, that's to say what is called Dari, which is different from Iranian Persian, but I found speaking, as I used to be able to in those days, essentially Tehrani Persian, I could get around perfectly well and people could understand me wherever I went, except maybe in Kandahar, but certainly in the other major cities and in the countryside and in Kabul itself, this was the lingua franca, really, of the country.
So there's a history of peace and peaceful coexistence, but suddenly there are battle lines drawn along ethnic lines.
Let's not turn pre-Soviet invasion Afghanistan into some sort of peaceful paradise. It hasn't by any means had an entirely peaceful history down the centuries.
We've got to take a quick break, Professor. We'll look at that when we come back. Yeah. We're talking about the ethnic and tribal patchwork of Afghanistan and how it may figure into the conflict that America is now part of. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Do you think that America will be good at handling the ethnic and tribal complexity on the ground in Afghanistan? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the ethnic and tribal patchwork of Afghanistan. What do you think is the best way to bring a lasting peace in Afghanistan? Can the balance between ethnic groups be restored after the bombing? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. David Morgan, a professor of history and religious studies at the University of Wisconsin, is with us, as is Kayum Karzai, founder of Afghans for a Civil Society. Our special news analyst, Jack Beattie, is here in the studio as well, and we want to hear from you. It looks as though America may be involved in nation building. We're going to have to understand a lot about how Afghanistan works if that's the case. We're at 1-800-423-8255. David Morgan, just before the break, you were talking about the history of the ethnic and tribal interaction in Afghanistan and saying it wasn't all peaceful. Are we in an unusually contentious period now?
There's been nothing like this at all. And such troubles as there have been have previously been internal, except when people were so foolish as to invade Afghanistan, as the British did twice in the 19th century and once in the early 20th. It hasn't always been enormously nice. The ruler of Afghanistan, Emir Abdurrahman, who ruled between 1880 and 1901, went around forcibly converting people to Islam in parts of the country, for example. Nonetheless, there are mechanisms for dealing with this sort of thing. You mentioned earlier on, I think, the notion of calling a lawyer jirga, this sort of traditional assembly of notables. And I think this is a very important idea, because what the United States has to avoid at all costs is any risk of being seen to impose a puppet government on Afghanistan.
So the lawyer jirga...
They have to produce it themselves.
So this great council, this lawyer jirga, would give legitimacy to whatever government follows the Taliban, if indeed the Taliban falls?
That would be in accordance with Afghan tradition. And, of course, the very important thing to remember about the Taliban is that they have no connection whatever with any kind of Afghan tradition. They are not a product of Afghanistan. They're a product of refugee camps in Pakistan.
Kayum Karzai, do you feel at this point that the Loya Jirga, the great council bringing together all these groups, would have the ability to give legitimacy to a government that might succeed the Taliban?
Absolutely, yes. But for the listener, let me explain as to what our traditional tradition of Loya Jirga is.
Please.
We in our history have enjoyed the Loya Jirgas in two forms to facilitate a normal course of conduct in our politics. One that we refer to is a consultative national Loya Jirga. The convening of this Loya Jirga is a top-down institution, always assumes the existence of a central government, and is summoned by the head of state. Government plays an important role in the election or selection of the delegates. Jirga plays the role of consultation, consent to a major policy or major social change that initiated by the government. Now, the Loya Jirga that we are talking about now, we always refer to it as a decision-making Loya Jirga. This is actually a bottom-up process that assumes no central government, and although there may be a precarious government like what we have now in the north or in the south of the Taliban, but it assumes a national condition of social and economic and political despair and indignation, which certainly we have now. And certain times in the history of Afghanistan, as in the recent years, when war loses national objective and purpose, which we have war in Afghanistan precisely in the same manner now, people must resort to this national loyajiga of that is a decision making.
So, what circumstances do you need in order to actually pull off this great council, this loyajiga meeting? Must it be in Afghanistan? How much peace do you have to pull together the individuals who would be required to have a legitimate meeting?
Well, the first thing that you must think about it is that this decision making loyajiga is a process. Although the history of Afghanistan does not record it as such. So this loyajiga that you see now that is building up on the horizon is the most important institution that could settle our problem, has started it in 1997. And actually the first meeting of that occurred in Islamabad, in which my father was Abdulhad Karzai, who was assassinated by the extremists of the Taliban, and Hamid Karzai, which is my brother, was, and don't want to go to the family, but they were instrumental in this meetings. And then, of course, I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question as to what.
Well, we're just thinking about how practical it is to have this group meet and make effective decisions in a time of war.
Well, the practicality comes because every other instrument of politics, whether forced by international, by regional powers or otherwise, has failed.
We can see
so
that.
The most important, so the condition that the people are in it is the environment that pushes that loyajiga in the traditional framework of the Afghan body politics is the only thing that is left that can solve the problem. So it is basically the mechanism of mass mobilization that would carry this loyajiga to the top of the groups.
Right. Kayyum Karzai, thanks for that. Jack Beatty, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has said recently, we're not here to do nation building. We're not smart enough to figure out of this welter of groups and interests where Afghanistan ought to go. We want Afghanistan to figure that out for itself, as if we can come and intervene and then step back and let this peacefully resolve into some orderly situation. What's your level of confidence in that unfolding?
Well, we haven't had a good track record in toppling regimes. That's just to understate matters. I mean, from Guatemala, where we essentially toppled a democratic regime and led to years of dictatorship. Iran, a democratic movement we toppled, led to years of dictatorship. In Vietnam, of course, we helped a coup against Diem, and that brought us years of illegitimate rule. The other model, of course, for American nation building is General MacArthur in Japan, who from top down sort of did nation building and created democracy where there was none in Japan. But the record hasn't been a good one. And when you look at the character of the Northern Alliance, with whom willy-nilly we seem to be thrown in here, it's not very comforting. The Human Rights Watch notices an ethnically sort of patterned quality to the violence that the minority groups that make up this alliance have been perpetrating, both against the Taliban but also against the ethnic majority to whom the Taliban belongs. I'm just wondering what our experts think about the prospect of this Northern Alliance taking government in Kabul.
Jack, to take that question on, I first want to say good night to David Morgan and thank him for joining us. Professor Morgan at the University of Wisconsin, thanks very much for being on board.
Thank you very
giving
much.
Us the background. And I want to bring in Peter Thompson. Peter Thompson is ambassador in residence at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He's the former American Special Envoy and ambassador to Afghanistan during the first Bush administration. Good evening, Ambassador Thompson.
Good evening.
I don't know if you just heard Jack Beatty's question, but he's asking, how deeply into Afghanistan's ethnic politics does the United States have to wade to help resolve the situation there? And what are the implications of making alliance with the Northern Alliance, which has its own kind of spotted human rights record?
Well, to answer the second part of your question first, we shouldn't ally ourselves with any Afghan faction or group. Indeed, what we should be doing, in my opinion, is to urge the countries that have been intervening inside Afghanistan. First, the Soviet Union intervened to attempt to put Afghan communists in power. Then elements in Pakistan and in the Gulf intervened to help set up this extremist Islamic coalition, which includes Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but also the Pakistani military intelligence has been there. That it's time to for all countries to step back and to let the Afghans resolve their own problems. They've had a country for 300 years. This Loya Jirga has been called from time to time in Afghan history to resolve leadership issues in times of crisis. They have their own institution. They've shown that their country does function. Indeed, there was a functioning democracy in the 1960s and early 70s before all the turmoil started, in which two parliaments were elected, civil liberties were advancing. So if you're talking about nation building, there's no need to build a nation. What we should be trying to do is helping the Afghans put their country back together. It's broken, it's fragmented, and the key to that is to use our great prestige and our leverage in the world through the United Nations to ask Afghanistan's neighbors to stop interfering and to defer to the United Nations. This Undersecretary for Afghan Affairs has just been appointed by the Secretary General. Mm-hmm. He's very competent, Luktar Brahimi. He's a former Algerian foreign minister and was the Secretary General's special envoy on Afghanistan in the mid-90s. He resigned in disgust with the Pakistani and Iranian interference in Afghanistan at the time. So it's time for all countries to more or less restore the classic buffer role of Afghanistan and Central Asia and to defer to the United Nations to move among the Afghan factions to help them put back together a consensus through a Loya Jirga process.
And yet, Ambassador Thompson, is it going to be possible for us to pursue the campaign that we're now part of without allying, at least now and then, with groups that have an ethnic, tribal face? We've already thrown our lot in some degree with the Northern Alliance. They're certainly celebrating the American entry into the war there. How can we be involved in Afghanistan but not involved in Afghani ethnic and tribal issues?
Well, at this point, we must help the anti-Taliban, anti-Osama bin Laden military centers, which are liberating more and more territory now in Afghanistan. We should not favor any one of them, and we should advise them not to seize Kabul. And indeed, the Northern Alliance has already privately agreed to this, that they will move down towards the capital, but they won't take it. And if you talk to the Zahir Shah advisors in Rome, they will fully agree that Kabul should not be taken by the tribes from the south.
That's news to me, Ambassador Thompson, that the Northern Alliance is not going to take Kabul, has agreed not to take it. Is that coming out of where do we hear that?
Well, I can't speak for the Northern Alliance, but there's Northern Alliance delegation was just in Rome, mm-hmm. and they had extensive talks and agreements. And part one of those agreements, as I understand it, was that neither side will attempt to seize Kabul, which if one gets
fascinating.
In, it will be very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the Afghan tribal and ethnic patchwork and the way ahead and the U.S. role in that way ahead. Simon is on the line. Welcome, Simon. You're on the air.
Good evening. How's it going?
It's going well, thanks.
I had a question about, we've heard a lot of talk recently about the former king being put back on the throne. Mm-hmm. And I'm basically questioning the validity of the statements that I've heard, which have basically indicated that the king would be able to sort of come in, take back over his old throne. He already has a support base really in place in Afghanistan, and he's going to be able to really redesign the infrastructure and sort of make everything good again, so to speak.
Yeah, good question. Let's put that to our guests. Thank you, Simon. Peter Thompson, what about the role of the king? He's not young. He hasn't been active in Afghan politics in any overt way for a long time. How important will or might he be in restoring stability there?
He has great potential to help in the settlement process because kings of Afghanistan have always presided over the Loyachurgas. However, you're quite right that he's very old and he has been inactive. He has announced his readiness to go back to Afghanistan and preside over the Loyachurga in a ceremonial way. His relatives point out that he has renounced his kingship, that he thinks the monarchy is no longer suitable for Afghanistan, but he's the only remaining national symbol for Afghanistan, and if he played this ceremonial role, it could smooth this Loyachurga process, which Mr. Karzai was talking about.
Right. Kayum Karzai, the king is also Pashtun. Would that make him an acceptable figure to the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, who are perhaps allied with other opposition forces to the Taliban now?
Yes, he will be acceptable to the great majority of Afghans for the reason that the conflict in Afghanistan for the great majority of the Afghan people is not ethnic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
It is a foreign imposed conflict, and actually the issues of ethnic conflict and the division between Pashto and Farsi, the division between Sunni and Shia, and the division between Pashtuns and the Tajiks, these are the classical thing of divide and rule. Neither one of these ethnic groups have called for the separation of the country, and they all speak about the national unity of the country, and the Northern Alliance never said that they were going to occupy Kabul and form a national government. They have endorsed the process of Loyachurga, and they have agreed to the mechanism of a Afghan broad-based national government.
So it sounds like there's some hope here if we can get to the other side of the current Taliban domination. We've got a call on the line from Noor, calling from Toronto, Canada. Welcome, Noor. You're on the air.
Okay. Good evening.
Good evening.
I totally agree with this remark which Mr. Karzai made.
Mm.
Actually, this conflict in Afghanistan is not conflict of ethnic groups. It is created by Pakistan. Now Pakistan is supporting, they are calling the government of Pashtuns dominated. Actually, in Afghanistan, there is no majority, no minority. Afghanistan is a collection of minorities. None of the ethnic groups are reaches to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Pashtuns are the larger
about
36-37.
Mm-hmm.
Tajiks makes about 32 in others. So actually the thing is that we have to encourage this national alliance that they have to make deal with the former king. They have already made, and we have not talked too much. They are a minority, they are corrupt, they are so and so. In Afghanistan, you cannot find pure person, pure politician.
Mm. Noor, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Peter Thompson. We just have a few seconds before a break, Peter Thompson. But the point gets made here that there are ethnic and tribal identities, but these have been exaggerated and the importance has been built up by outside influences. You agree?
Yes, I agree entirely. For instance, the Pakistani military intelligence emphasized not only the Pashtuns, but the radical Pashtuns, and that was represented by the Taliban and also by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and other puppets that Pakistan has attempted to put in power inside Kabul. And as long as that happens, war will continue to tear Afghanistan.
We're talking about navigating Afghans' ethnic, tribal, and political waters as the U.S. moves in to join the military situation there. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Do you think we're ready to help Afghanistan rebuild out of the rubble that it's currently in? You can also get into the conversation online. Talk about the long-term solutions to the political instability in Afghanistan. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Afghan patchwork of ethnic and tribal alliances this hour with Ambassador Peter Thompson, Afghan expert Kayum Karzai, and our special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty. Will the U.S. assault on Afghanistan worsen the social chaos there or help resolve it? Does America have a responsibility to help reestablish political balance when the shooting is over? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Thompson, I want to ask you about the Pashtun group. I know that extends very substantially beyond Afghanistan's borders and into Pakistan, where support for the Taliban has been very strong. Are Pashtuns monolithic in their support of the Taliban? Is support stronger within Afghanistan or in Pakistan at this point?
You find a general divide between, on the one hand, the tribal aristocracy, and I would say the bulk of the Afghan Pashtun population, and the bulk of the Pakistan Pashtun population, on the one hand, and the more radical elements among the Pashtuns, in particular the mullahs, and the religious students who have gone to these Gulf-funded madrasas during the Soviet occupation and been imbibing this more radical version of Islam, which the mullahs sort of level of the Pashtun population supports. The Taliban represent this element, as do the radical religious parties inside Pakistan, which together have never gotten more than 7% of votes in democratic elections in Pakistan since independence.
Mm-hmm. But the Pashtun and Taliban-sympathizing Pashtun have worked their way deeply into the Pakistani military and intelligence services. Even if we can solve this situation somehow or create a space for peace inside Afghanistan, you were saying earlier that the countries surrounding should just stay out. Is there a realistic hope of that?
I think there is. If the leadership, President Musharraf, is convinced that this is best for Pakistan, that following the old course will just result in more instability, which will backfire on Pakistan. But we should remember that in the general staff in Pakistan and in the military, too, the great bulk of officers are secular. They see this as they saw this Islamist coalition inside of Afghanistan as valuable for strategic reasons, vis-a-vis building strategic depth against India. The more green in back of Pakistan, the better. And they erroneously, I think many of them have concluded, supported the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Taliban, and Pakistani religious party combination. But that's come back to bite them and to provide great disadvantages that we've seen. And I think that the firing of the head of the Pakistani military intelligence called the ISI by President Musharraf 2 days ago was
yes.
very significant.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joe is on the line calling from Alden, New York. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
After the U.S. Civil War and in Germany after World War II, mm-hmm. the men that had made up the attacking governments, you know, the governments that were defeated, were then prevented by law from participating in any post-war governments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good thing. I think it led to long-term stability. If you let the people that caused the problem back in, it seems to me they're going to use their new positions and new authority to kind of try to extend the same policies. My question is it reasonable or advantageous or even possible for the U.S. to say after this conflict in whatever post-war government there is, no Taliban?
Good question. Thank you, Joe. Kayum Karzai, after, and again, we're assuming that there's an after in which the Taliban is somehow pushed from power. Is there any role for the Taliban in a post-conflict Afghanistan? And if not, does that mean that Pashtuns will somehow feel disadvantaged?
To answer this question, let me put forward this explanation for your listeners. The Taliban is by no means the representatives of the Pashtun groups. In fact, they are the antithesis of the Pashtun value structure.
Mm-hmm.
It is a collective totalitarian ideology that is promoted only in the context of radical Islam. Their goal is far beyond Afghanistan. They are international in character. in their decision-making body. They're mostly Arabs, Chechens, Chinese, Uzbeks, and other nationalities that are represented. So it is extremely difficult for us to think that somehow the Taliban's are representative of the Pashtun groups, and the Pashtun internal body politics in Afghanistan will be in the disadvantage if they're in power or if they fail.
So do you mean by that that in the future they could be excluded or should be excluded?
These are the questions that could be settled in the context of the Loya Jirga. Mm-hmm. The Loya Jirga is designed precisely to answer these questions, and also the question to separate the moderate Taliban from the radical Taliban will be the issue that the Loya Jirga would address, and I personally think that it is very, very important that the burden of nation building and the burden of the choosing of leadership should be left to the Afghans. And to the extent that extreme Islam and terrorism exist in Afghanistan, and I must submit that it will be impossible to think that it will that these extremism and these terrorism will exist in Afghanistan without the backing from Pakistan. Mm. And I think to put pressure on Pakistan to take hands off from the Afghan politics is an important issue that the United Nations, the international community should deal with. And the nation building and the self-determination question should be left to the institution of the Loya Jirga Prize.
We've got it. Peter Thompson, how about you from your perspective? Can the Taliban be excluded in a post-Taliban power era?
I agree with Mr. Karzai that if we, the United States, or Pakistan, or Iran, or Russia, say this person or this group should be excluded, we'll be going into their internal politics. They will sort it out. If the Loya Jirga is held, it will be representative of the whole country, and there is no question that they will reject these extremists.
Jack Beatty here in our studio. We've been learning a lot about this region over the past few weeks. What you hear is a cry for Afghanistan to be left alone and the presumption that their ethnic groups will work it out if they are. But how confident are you that Iran, that Pakistan, that the stands to the north will stay out?
Well, you know, if I were a policymaker there, I think I would put on my wall, do no harm to Pakistan, because important as Afghanistan is, it's Pakistan that is the country there that we really have to worry about. And the one thing we don't want to do is to do something within Afghanistan that's going to upset the balance of forces within Pakistan. The general there has made an extraordinary, historic decision to side with us. And already there seems to be some tension between what we want to do in Pakistan and what he understands we want to do. And we don't want to do in a position where we're setting up groups within Afghanistan that are going to create problems for him in Pakistan, because Pakistan is a nuclear-armed nation, and any sort of ethnic fissures there would have just vast geopolitical consequences, whereas anything that happens in Afghanistan, by comparison, is relatively less important.
Mm. Peter Thompson, you describe a kind of free-fire political zone around Afghanistan to let Afghans work this out, but is there not just the opposite danger that would turn into a vacuum that could invite more problems?
No, I don't think so. And it's not a win-lose situation. Afghanistan mm-hmm. wins, Pakistan loses. It's a win-win situation. And I think the decisions by President Musharraf, constructive decisions in the last 2 weeks, will result, if they continue in this direction, Pakistan, in a win-win situation for not only the two countries, but the entire region. Pakistan is an important neighbor of Afghanistan. It's a Muslim neighbor of Afghanistan, and it does have interest in seeing stability in Afghanistan. I hope it dawns on the leaders of Pakistan, I hope they accept that the policies that have been followed, these Islamic extremist policies that have been followed and implemented by the ISI, the military intelligence of Pakistan, have been counterproductive to Pakistan's interests.
Thank you, Peter Thompson, for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And Kayum Karzai, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Peter Thompson is the former American Special Envoy and ambassador to Afghanistan during the first Bush administration. Kayum Karzai is founder of Afghans for a Civil Society. Our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, is a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. You can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and Special Coverage Forums. Now, a view from the back pages of the newspaper. Carolyn Gilbert is founder of the International Association of Obiturists. She says the sheer number of sudden deaths on September 11th test the obituary writer in new ways.
I'm a student of the obituary. My fellow obituarists and I often urge writers to think of the obituary as a story of life rather than death. However, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to write this volume of obituaries without pointing to the unimaginable moment that stole these lives from us. Because I'm so attuned to the value and importance of the obituary, I can't help but think of the thousands being written as a result of the events of September the 11th, 2001. Like the concentric circles that fan out from a stone dropped in a calm lake, these obituaries are rippling out through newspapers in our country and the world. While the points of impact were New York City, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania, the hometowns of the victims stretched from sea to shining sea and beyond. Not merely a list of accomplishments and survivors, these obituaries must convey the heart and soul of the subjects. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe have long enjoyed a reputation for excellence in obituary circles. The stables of journalists who compose the magic words for the rich and famous, eccentric, or ingenious bring honor to the obituary pages of each daily edition. The thousands of deaths resulting from the tragedies have created a unique need for a different kind of remembrance, something between a formal obituary and a death notice. The fact that so many of the victims are listed as missing further complicates the finality of an obituary. To their credit, these newspapers and numbers of others across the country have responded in a variety of meaningful ways. A glance at the New York Times reveals the way in which they have sought to honor each person with a vignette of his or her life. Not the cut-and-dried formal obituary, these give us the heart and soul of each person. These thoughtful vignettes serve to humanize each person in a way that makes us wish we had known them sooner. It has been pointed out that at the rate of 10 to 15 profiles a day, it will be at least a year before all are honored. This volume of obituaries is very different from most. It is not the typical listing of the end of mature lives, with lists of awards and recognitions upon retirement. The obituary chapter of September 11 reveals names of many of our best and brightest who came to seek their fortunes in our nation's gleaming alabaster cities. Smart young professionals ascending in their careers, mid-managers, food service workers, custodians, crusty old pros, accountants, attorneys, merchants, delivery people, media consultants, producers, firefighters, police, security guards, pilots, flight attendants, international citizens, American citizens, all ages, all sizes, all races and ethnicities, all religions. Yet when all is said and done, these obituaries reveal each person to be a son, a daughter, a mother, a father, a grandparent, a husband, a wife, a companion, a friend, cherished by someone, somewhere. Whether the obituary is written for one of the unsuspecting victims of September the 11th, or for one of the perpetrators of terror, the stories of thousands of lives will be told for posterity in this volume of obituaries.
Carolyn Gilbert is the founder of the International Association of Obituarists. She lives in Dallas, Texas. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. To listen to or read other radio diaries and to see photos of the FBI's most wanted terrorists, log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.